Hello.
Hello. Standard Zoom beginning. I can hear you, but I can't see you.
Well, let's see. There.
Oh, that's good. There you go. Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Can I get you to turn your phone on its side?
Sure.
Brilliant. That just makes it so much easier for YouTube if I ever get around to putting them up on YouTube, but still. Great. So, hello. How's it going?
It's going good. It's going good. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. I'm pretty good. Yeah.
It's Friday, so, you know.
Yeah. Well, I always like to think about it, you know, not just go, oh, yeah, everything's great. I'm fine, you know, because, I don't know, people kind of do that, don't they? They just kind of habitually go, yeah, great, I'm good, I'm fine, everything's great.
That's true. Well, you just, you know, you never know if somebody's being genuine, I guess, if they really want to know, or if it's just, you know, a passing thing.
Yeah, it's true. It's actually quite disturbing if someone's honest with you. it can be just a little bit shocking, you know. I had a friend who was like that, and he was, you know, people would say, how are you? He'd go, yeah, I'm not great. Not great today. A little bit this, a little bit that. And we're like, oh, okay. And they're like, I didn't really want to know that. Could you not just say you're fine and we can get on to the bit, you know, the next bit?
Oh, I know. Well, you know, I think too, as an artist, when you saying that made me think of how, you know, when people tell you they love your work, I often think, well, do you really like it? Or are you just saying that? Or are you just being kind? You know, you sometimes would like to know like what they really think.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. Well, actually, I wouldn't like to know, but yeah, I know what you mean. okay, right. Now, hang on. Let me get down to business here. Right. So for someone who's listening, I'm talking to Amanda Grieve in Illinois. It is Illinois, isn't it? I've got that bit right.
Yes. Central Illinois.
Yes. Central Illinois. Okay. And just to give a time context for our conversation for someone listening in the future, today is Friday, the 28th of August. Here in Ireland, where I am, we came out of lockdown mostly, then we hesitated. There was a little bit of a resurgence. Now there's talk about going into another lockdown, and there's a big backlash against that because there's only actually 6 people in ICU and 22 people in hospital in Ireland, country of, you know, 4.5 million with COVID, and they're talking about a lockdown again. So people are, you know, no. So how are things where you are, Amanda?
Well, you know, in the US things are not that great. We have a considerable amount of people with COVID. Pretty disturbing. And where I am, it's not good, but it's not terrible. So we've been pretty lucky. Things are open for the most part. We have mask mandates, and most of our schools are doing remote learning. So it's not terrible. I mean, there's still a lot of pushback, which is for me a little frustrating. I think wearing masks isn't such a huge deal. So if it's something that's going to help slow down the spread, then, you know, we shouldn't be balking about wearing them. But you know, it's not terrible here, I guess, where I am.
Good.
But it's a pretty rural area where I am. So I live out in the country, and the closest town is, you know, 11,000 people. So it's not a huge area.
Yeah, right. Yeah, same as me. Well, like where I live is, I think it's 5,000 or something is the local town I'm with. Beside or near, but yeah, it's rural. Yeah. And yeah, it seems to be very different story in the cities, and different in America, state by state. And then in the world, country by country, it's very different. Same thing, but different.
Yeah. I think for the most part where I am, nursing homes seem to be affected the most. Now, I don't know if that'll be different once schools start opening up for in-person learning. You know, it might be a different story then, but for now it seems like most of the outbreaks are in nursing homes and skilled nursing facilities.
What's a skilled nursing facility?
Kind of like a nursing home, like a rehab place, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Same here. Nursing home, meatpacking plants, and direct provision. Direct provision are where refugees go.
Oh, okay.
Just terrible. Yeah, it's a terrible system. It's not good, but those are where our clusters are happening.
Well, I always think like a year ago, I would have never thought that this is the situation we would be in. But you know, I'm an artist now, but my graduate training is in epidemiology. And so, you know, we were always told that this was something that would probably be an eventuality, and, you know, that wearing masks and social distancing and all of that was pretty much just par for the course. And it's pretty basic standard public health information. And so even though you're told that it's something that will eventually happen, you don't think that it'll happen anytime in your lifetime.
Yeah. So if people could have dinner parties, you would be really popular guest at a dinner party.
Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah. Did you work in that field or did you just study in that field?
I worked briefly in it. And then I also worked in legal research and actually helped write a book for medical students on biostatistics and epidemiology. But that feels like it was eons ago.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay. We might get back to that. But let's get on to the art. I'm just curious about it myself. Okay, so yeah, for someone listening who hasn't seen your work, how would you describe your paintings?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I hesitate to say magical realism because they're realist, but I wouldn't necessarily say that they're in the realm of like, you know, like a Mark Ryden or something like that. There's a magical element. There's an element that is unrealistic to them, I think, with the flower faces and the botanical element to it. But yeah, I would say probably figurative, magical, realist, in a sense. I'm curious what you would say, what you would think.
How would I describe them? Powerful, slightly disturbing, very well executed, very high level of skill, beautiful, and a lot of depth, where there's sort of paintings that you can look at over and over and over again and have different, or even just in one view, go through a number of emotions or feelings. As I say, a little bit shocking initially, then sort of see the beauty, then start wondering what's that there for, why is that, oh no, that's not what I thought it was, it's something else, and you know, and on and on and on and on. So yeah, I think they're quite brilliant actually.
Well, thanks. I'm not gonna be able to fit my head through the door now.
Okay, and that's the end of the podcast.
Talk to you later.
Yeah, that was great. It's all downhill from here. Right, so just to put your sensibilities in context, who are your creative heroes and are they all artists?
Oh man, that's a hard one. You know, I have artists that I really like, but for me, I try not to pay too much attention to other artists because, well, for one, as an artist, I have a pretty fragile ego. And so, you know, you see all these wonderful things and it makes you feel like, oh God, I'm never going to be that good. But the other part is that I don't want to be too influenced by them. I don't want that to filter into my work because I'm always cognizant of, you know, the argument that there isn't an original piece of work. There isn't really an original thought now that yeah. It's all just kind of like regurgitation. So I don't know. I mean, I really like Doriel Kamy's work. I like Brad Kunkel's work. I love Ashley Longshore. Who else? There are a ton of like contemporary artists that I really like right now. Erin Milan, I really like her work too. And, you know, I'm also influenced by art history. So, you know, I loved, Bronzino. I liked him. I don't know, you know, I guess those are kind of generic answers, but long story long, I try to not focus too much on looking at other artists' work and try to make it as original and me as I can.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think you're doing a good job of that. All right. Nat, we've had questions come in, lots of questions come in, so we'll get on to them. Natalie Featherston says, I love how your work moves beyond the technical process of the realist representation of the figure to incorporate a strong narrative and symbolism. Where do you find inspiration and how do you catalog those ideas for future paintings?
I get a lot of inspiration. First of all, I love Natalie Featherstone's work too. She's amazing.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah. Yes. I get a lot of inspiration from reading books. I mean, I'm a voracious reader. If I'm not painting or running, I'm reading most of the time. And also from song lyrics. So I would say my inspiration is not really like visual. It's more just, I might see a phrase in a book and I'll screenshot it and put it in a album on my phone so that I can go back to it or, write it down in a notebook or something like. And, you know, honestly, I get a lot of my inspiration from fiction books. You know, I love to read science fiction. I love to read about magic. And I think that there is an empathy that's present in fiction writing that you don't necessarily get from other books. And it's teachable in that sense, but it's really inspirational to me. Even just... you know, I was recently reading a book and they mentioned the idea of a ruelle, and it was a, you know, it was an artistic gathering that was orchestrated and overseen by a woman, but it was usually in her bedroom. And the idea of that, the notion of that is really intriguing to me. And it's something that, you know, I would like to explore even more.
Yeah. So what's been good like that you've read recently?
That I've read recently. I just finished a book called The 10,000 Doors of January. And it was a wonderful book about this girl. As she's growing up, I don't want to ruin it, but she finds these magical doors. And she is running from these people that are trying to close these doors. And she ends up finding out that she was born in another world and came through this door with her father. And to me, you know, it was metaphorical in the sense that it's like, you know, you have these doorways to imagination, you know, you can go down this rabbit's hole of, at least I do, you know, I think as an artist too, like one of our main tools is daydreaming, right? I mean, to just sit there and let your mind wander and you think about things. And so, and to that end also, you know, when I'm reading or watching a movie or even listening to a song, it's like you become a character in it, even though you're not, you're almost like completely ensconced in this book or this story. And so, yeah, I mean, it was a really good book and there were a lot of screenshots taken so that I could, you know.
So do you like to hold a paper book, or are you a Kindle person, or do you like listen like audiobooks?
I listen to audiobooks a lot of times when I'm painting, and those are more, I would say that I listening to like biographies or stuff like that when I'm painting. But right now it's, you know, I almost am embarrassed to say that I do read a lot on my Kindle. I used to be, you know, hard and fast, just paperback or, you know, paper books, but it's so easy now. And I kind of love the immediacy of seeing a book that I like and ordering it immediately and it being there for me to read in that moment.
Yeah.
So, and you know, you can argue too, it's saving trees and, you know.
Yes, definitely. I'll argue for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also the other thing of like, you get the information, and then if there's a book that you really love, then you can order the hardback version of it. And there's a lot, I don't know, it's more of a treasured object than I think.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. I was that way with the Lord of the Rings trilogy. That was like, you know, I coveted that for a very long time and still have my copy. And it's one of those things where, you know, I won't lend it out to anybody because I want to make sure that, you know, it stays with me. And there's nothing special about it. It's just that, you know, I remember, it's the memory of reading it and being in that moment and the way you felt and how it was captivating and transformative in a way, you know?
Yeah. 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 Okay. Jenny Tucker Kennedy in Illinois says, have you always known you wanted to be an artist? And at what age did you start painting? She has a couple of questions, but we'll start with that one.
Well, I didn't know that I was going to be an artist until probably 15 years ago. I'm 42, so it wasn't that long ago. Before that, it's weird because I grew up in a family of artists and musicians. I mean, it was always around, you know, you'd walk into my grandparents' house and my grandpa would be strumming his guitar. And, you know, my grandma had paintings all over the house that she'd done. And my mom was also an artist. And so I never really, I guess because you're around it all the time, you just never, you think that that's normal and you never really, there was never like the pressure or the idea that I had to be it. It's just, that's just what I was around. I mean, whenever I was growing up and going to college and all that, I was really into science. And so I had a degree in molecular biology and epidemiology. And then I ended up, because I married a farmer. So, you know, you marry a farmer, you also marry the area. And so I ended up getting a job in legal research. And I had a really tremendous boss who let me take classes at the local community college. And so I decided to take an art class just because, and I loved it, and just kind of snowballed from there.
All right. Okay, our next question is, how long does it take for you to finish a painting?
It depends. This last one I finished took, let's see, 4 months. But then again, I had my daughter with me and it was kind of touch and go. I mean, if I can get 2 or 3 hours in a day now, that's pretty good. So and I'm painting smaller. So I would say right now, normally it takes me maybe a month, sometimes two, if it's a little bit bigger. But like I said, with coronavirus and everything and remote learning and all that entails, that it took a little bit longer with this last one.
Right. And then our last question is, do you draw the entire picture before starting to paint?
Yes. Yeah, I do. Now, I draw it in, but I wouldn't necessarily say that's set in stone. There are a lot of times that I'll, you know, change something while I'm in the moment. Because, you know, what is in your head, or I guess what you worked on in Photoshop or whatever, doesn't always translate once you get it in onto the canvas. So I would say, yes, I draw it, but it's not set in stone.
All right. What do you draw with? Like pencil or charcoal or paint?
Just pencil. Just a number two.
Pencil.
Yep.
Number two. Okay. Anna Kroner in Denmark says, I'd like to know about the inspiration for your stunning compositions. And then she says, I love your work. Thank you.
Oh, that's nice. The inspiration. Well, honestly, the inspiration is my family and friends, and I say my family and friends, but it's the women that I talk to. I have four sisters, and you know, we talk a lot about equality and feminism and just kind of the things that they encounter in their lives. And so, yeah, the stories that my friends tell me, that my family members, my sisters tell me, are really what serve as the inspiration. And also, you know, living on a farm, being like basically surrounded by botanica and being a gardener and the, like what flowers, what the symbolism is and in what is what I would consider personally symbolic as far as the floral element that I found that inspirational too.
Yeah. And is that something that you've just come to yourself, or, you know, have you studied the symbolism of flowers and then put your own interpretation on it?
Yes. I would say that the second part is true.
The second one. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Part of that too is like you see a flower that's beautiful and you kind of wonder like the history of it or the meaning behind it, or even just whether it's poisonous, you know. And to me, that is kind of a symbolism in its own right, or if it was used for medicinal purposes, that sort of thing. So, I mean, I look at like what would maybe be traditionally considered symbolic, but then also its uses and how its uses can be symbolic as applied to the female.
Right. Does the biology, your knowledge of biology and molecular biology, does that get in the way? But it's sort of like an artist going to an art gallery. It's a very different experience to someone who's not an artist going. So when you're looking at plants, do you have all that, you know, molecular biology information kind of piling in on top of what you're looking at as well?
Well, I wouldn't say, I mean, I guess maybe it's present. I would say that it maybe informs it in the sense that, you know, well, it's kind of like, you know, whenever you think of like human anatomy and you think of like Leonardo, when he would do autopsies, like looking at the muscles and the bones in order to inform himself and to make it, you know, to be able to paint or draw the human figure. I guess in that sense, yeah, you know, it informs the way you draw or the way you paint intrinsically, but I wouldn't necessarily say that I look at it and I, you know, like the picture of, you know, a plant cell or you know, it's the systemic part of it really comes to mind whenever I'm looking, you know.
All right. Okay, you sort of mentioned Photoshop. Do you draw from life or photos or a combination of both?
Usually from photos.
Do you work from life, yeah.
Yeah, you know, mostly from photos, just because it does take a while. I mean, I would never expect somebody to come and sit for me, you know, over a month's long period and for several hours a day. So yeah, it's just easier, and honestly, it's not really something that's conceivable or that is something I can normally do. So yeah, photographs usually, and some of like maybe the more like the objects and stuff I might have with me to reference. So I guess in that sense, maybe there's a little bit of painting or drawing from life in that sense, but for the most part, photographic.
Right. And do you organize photo shoots for, you know, your painting, or how do you do that side of it?
Yeah, I do. A lot of times what I'll do is get together with a friend or, you know, it might be like, you know, maybe a mutual friend will say, hey, you should talk to this person and they would be a great subject. And so a lot of times what it ends up being is meeting for coffee and telling them about my work and like what it means and, you know, asking them, you know, if they would like to be a part of it and if they would like to talk about what their experience as a woman has been. And so it's pretty intimate in that respect. And also, you know, I feel really lucky because these women are kind of like entrusting their story with me. Yes. Allowing me to visually portray, you know, something that they have experienced. So I really do covet that too. You know, I know that it's kind of I consider it a pretty big responsibility. You know, I don't take it lightly.
Yeah. Okay. Alicia Brown in Jamaica says, how do you go about choosing your model for a particular piece? I'm a big fan of your work and I can't wait to listen to your talk with John. Keep doing an exceptional job.
Aw, how nice. I love that. You're going to have to...
Can you talk about how you choose your model for a particular piece? So you kind of mentioned it, but yeah, is there anything else you want to add to that?
You know, I guess there have been times when I've got an idea ahead of talking to the model. For instance, I did a piece about Medusa, or kind of like my take on Medusa's story. And, you know, a friend of mine so graciously modeled for me. And so I had the idea before I had spoken to her, and she was game, and I really appreciated that. So, you know, it's, you know, the, I guess like a chicken and egg sort of thing. Sometimes it's, you know, I already have a planned out idea, and then it's finding somebody who is willing to, and really who can trust me to portray them this way. Because, you know, there's also that notion that, or it's been my experience anyway, if you don't trust the person who is photographing you, or, you know, or painting, whatever, that translates in the image. So, you know, I'm very lucky that the people that model for me, my friends and my sisters, and people, frankly, who I don't necessarily know at first, but then become friends after the fact, trust me. And so I'm glad that so far, anyway, knock on wood, it's translated into decent paintings.
Yeah. Do you do color studies or value studies before you start the main picture?
No, I just go right into it.
Okay.
To me, I mean, it takes so long, and I guess I'm not traditional in that respect. I just kind of jump into it. There are no studies. There are no there are no value or color studies. I just kind of go with it. And the other part of that too is that I kind of have a pretty consistent palette that I work with. So I already kind of know like how it's going to turn out. And so, yeah, I don't, maybe I should try doing that, but no, I don't.
So what is your consistent palette? What do you, roughly?
Well, I guess I can look at my drawer here. I use ultramarine blue deep. I love Holbein colors, so I use a lot of those.
Right.
Yellow ochre, burnt umber, some Prussian blue, phthalo green, alizarin crimson. You know, there's about 10 or so that I love, that I just,
okay,
that I use.
And what's your go-to black and white?
Well, my black, I mix myself. So I
okay,
use phthalo green and alizarin crimson, and it makes this really like deep black. And, you know, those are both pretty transparent colors, but when you mix them together, for whatever reason, it ends up being fairly opaque. And but it has a depth to it that I really like. And then white, I use mostly titanium white. With a little one running around, I tend to shy away from, you know, like a lead white, but
yeah,
titanium usually.
Yeah.
That's my go-to.
With the black, did you try other blacks and just get frustrated and went, oh, I'm just going to do this myself? Or how did you come to that black?
No, I had my mentor, my teacher, he gave me, when I first started painting, he gave me, he gave all of his students a list of different color combinations. And that was one of them. And it's just one that I've used ever since I've painted.
Right.
Because I just love it. And I, you know, I've used other blacks, but they just seem a little too chalky to me, a little too flat. So this one I really like because it does have a lot of depth.
Hmm. Okay, I have a feeling a lot of people will be trying that out. what do you like to paint on, and why? You know, like what's your go-to substrate?
I paint on wood panels. I used to do, you know, I used to stretch my own canvas and do all that. But for me, I don't like the bounce. I like having just a hard surface. And for me, you know, it also lends itself to detail work. So you've got this smooth, like almost glassy surface that's pretty easy to get, you know, a lot of fine detail in. And so that's why I like it.
Okay. You haven't tried aluminium or anything like that?
No, I've seen that. And I've thought about that. It's just, for me, I guess maybe also it's the ease with which I can get a wood panel. You know, I can go to my local hardware store and get like shelving. And I've used, you know, tabletops sometimes that they sell there. So But yeah, okay. I am intrigued by that. I would.
So nice lightweight paintings.
Oh, right. Well, you know, it's funny because when I got the tabletops, it was kind of, I thought like, well, they're very domestic, right? I mean, that's, if there's anything that's kind of like traditionally considered in the feminine realm, it's the idea of hearth and home. And so using tabletops for my round paintings, those are all, you know, they're small tables anyway. So I, you know, own credit, they're not, you know, huge tables, but, but yeah, I thought that added kind of an interesting element to it because, you know, the substrate itself is very domestic.
Yeah. Okay. So you talked about drawing. Do you do grisailles or do you just go straight into color?
I just go straight into color, but I am intrigued by the idea of like toning. And I always say like the next one, I'm going to do some sort of grisaille or some sort of tone, but then I, you know, that's the impatient person in me, I guess. Maybe it's the Aries in me or something, but I just have to just jump right into it.
Okay. Right. Tyler Streeter in San Francisco asks, how do you get those great blacks? So you've kind of answered that. Anything else you want to add about the blacks?
Well, I don't know. I mean, as far as like the phthalo green, alizarin crimson mix, it's great because, you know, it can go more green. It can go more purple. I would say that I also use a lot of ultramarine deep and burnt umber. So that's more, I guess I would consider that like a warmer black, and mixing those two combinations together to create different like subtleties within the blacks. So yeah.
Yeah. Great. Very good. Do you have a favorite type of brush or make of brush or palette knife that you like to use?
I love rosemary brushes. They are wonderful. And I think there are probably a lot of people that like the rosemary brushes, but.
It's sort of like, it seems like, you know, people who like them love them. And then there are people who don't dislike them, but they're just ambivalent. They're just in with all the other, you know, mix of brushes. But if it seems like if you like them, you love them. Yeah, I like them a lot myself.
Yeah. So do you use them exclusively or do you you have other ones?
No.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to be in that camp of like, oh, a brush is a brush, whatever. I just use what I've got. And then I started using them and I was like, you know, oh, now I see it. Now I see why people really like these. So yeah. And you know, it takes a while for them to get to me in Illinois, but it's worth the wait. So they're wonderful.
Yeah. And do you have a preference for flats or filberts or rounds or?
I use a lot of filberts and a lot of rounds. So yeah. And you should, you know, I would say, oh, I don't know, zeros and, you know, the triple zero or the 10-aught, something like that. I would say I tend towards smaller brushes than the bigger ones.
All right. And no palette knife work at all, or?
No, just to mix my paints. I'm pretty methodical on my palette, you know, to do it that way. But yeah, otherwise, no.
Yeah. Doesn't look like this any palette knife work though. I just thought I'd ask. how do you check yourself as you're going along? Like some artists use mirrors a lot, or they turn the canvas upside down, or they'll use their phone a lot for pictures, or they'll get their friends in to give them some critiques. What do you do?
I use my phone a lot, just taking pictures and seeing that. And then, you know, I use my mom too, because she'll come in and she's not afraid to tell me, oh, that looks a little wonky, or why are you doing it that way? And you know, so yeah, I appreciate her candor on that too. So yeah, and now my daughter's getting a little bit older, so she comes in and she, you know, critiques it also, so it'll be cool whenever she gets even older and we can have our conversations.
How old is your daughter?
She's six.
Six. Oh yeah, God, they're ruthless.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah, they don't pull their punches. What kind of lighting setup do you have in your studio?
Well, nothing really fancy. I actually just use the overhead light. My studio is what used to be my dining room, so it's just the chandelier or light that's in my dining room is what I use.
Okay. And are there a lot of windows? Like, do you use a lot of natural light, or is it all artificial lighting?
It's all artificial. Yeah, I do have some windows, but for me, the way the window is angled, it provided too much glare. So,
yeah, right. So, yeah. What you said, you listen to audiobooks, but do you listen to music or podcasts as well when you're working?
Oh yeah. Well, hey, I listen to your podcast when
I'm working.
Of course,
everybody listens to my podcast.
No, it's great. I love it. And yeah, I mean, well, like right now, I just not that long ago listened to your interview with Sarah Muirhead, and that was really great. Yeah. And I've been listening to podcasts about New Orleans. I don't know. I'm just really, really interested in New Orleans right now. So I've been listening about the history of that city. And yeah, I have music that I listen to. I like Sylvan Esso right now. And shoot, there are a few others. But yeah, it just kind of depends on the mood, right?
Yeah, so an eclectic kind of music mix?
Yeah, I would say mostly alternative. I mean, I don't know. Some classical. To be honest, that's maybe probably I listen to classical music more just because there aren't any words in it. So, you don't get so, your mind doesn't get so gummed up by the actual verses and stuff. You can just kind of float along with the instruments.
Yeah, great. Do you have like a quirky tool, paint, medium, some unusual thing that you know that you don't know of any other artist use that somebody listening might be, you know, surprised to know about?
I'm not sure if I do. I mean, I use some of my daughter's little, like, these little, like, cups to do some mixing. And then I use some makeup brushes. You know, used for for blending. So
the makeup brushes are for blending, and you use them for painting or paint blending.
For blending the paints, yeah. Well, you know, so you can. I guess you can. I'm sure you can get them, you know, at an art store. But I just love how soft they are, and they, you know, after you've painted something, you can just kind of erase the brush marks with them. So, and they're, I don't know, they're a little bit cheaper, I think.
Yeah, I use watercolor brushes for that. But yeah, I mean, I've looked at my wife's you know, makeup brushes, and thought, I wonder, could you paint with them? So that's great. They work out okay. Do you use like big ones, or what sort of size are they?
I do. Well, here, they're like, this one is, well, it doesn't say, but it's a total face brush from Elf is what I'm using for my blending now.
That looks like a little bit shy of 3/4 of an inch wide, is it?
Oh, even more, I would say.
1/2 inch.
I would say, well, the actual brush itself is probably 1.5 inches. I mean, it's just like a big
palm. The top bit, yeah. But the, what do they call that? The ferrule?
The ferrule, the handle of it.
That's about 1/2 inch, is it? Yeah
I would say so,
great.
Yeah.
And you just use that like a fan brush or a...
Right, like a badger brush or something like that. You just, you know, erase all the brush marks out. Yeah.
What a great tip. Okay, I have to go now. I have to go and get some blood pressure.
Talk to you later.
Yeah. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, God, I'm really enjoying this podcast. I've listened to a few now and they're brilliant. And there's so many of them. And I've learned so much from listening to them. And you know what? If I met that John Dalton fella in real life, I'd love to buy him a cup of tea and have a chat with him. I'd love to do that every month if I could. Well, now you can. The tea part, at least, because this podcast runs on cups of tea bought for me by people like you who listen to the podcast and send me the price of a cup of tea once a month through the Patreon account. That's patreon.com/John Dalton, gently does it, all one word. And if you're one of those people who already send me cups of tea through Patreon, thanks a million. The tea is lovely and I really appreciate it. Now, the great thing is that if you can't afford to send me the price of a cup of tea or you don't want to, that's fine. You still get exactly the same podcast for free. It's sort of an honor system where the people who can afford it and want to pay for the people who can't or don't want to. So it's all lovely. So if you'd like to send me a cup of tea once a month, you can do that through Patreon. I'd really appreciate it. It makes a huge difference to me. All right. Michelle Marin says, I notice a lot of flowers in your work. What do they symbolize? So you've kind of mentioned it. But right. If there's anything else you want to add to that?
You know, gosh, I don't know. It's hard to like pinpoint an actual like a flower meaning or floral meaning, because I, you know, use more of like a bouquet, I guess, patchwork, I guess, of flowers together. Now this last one that I worked on, I'm kind of intrigued with the idea of house plants, and maybe that's come from, you know, being isolated and being in our homes. And I think, or I've read that like owning house plants has become a thing now that we're all in quarantine. But I'm also kind of intrigued by the idea of house plants and how it relates to femininity and like the traditional sense of what society thinks women should be like, or what the notion of what is considered traditionally feminine, and how it relates to house plants. So like this last one, I used a pothos plant, and it was, it's more like like a vine, or, you know, it's wrapped around the figure a little bit, not like in a menacing sort of way or restrictive way, I guess. But yeah, just the idea of being wrapped up in the home and hearth.
Yeah. Okay. I did, even though I don't do research anymore, I did happen to read today, strangely, coincidentally, that you were talking about flowers as a metaphor for women, and how they are perceived in terms of like beauty, passivity, you know, like the cliched kind of the birds and the bees story. Well, the bees part is the bee, you know, would be the sort of male active part, and the flower would be the female part. Am I on the right track there, or, you know, can you talk a little bit more about that side of it?
Well, sure. So yeah, whenever I think of flowers, and how they relate to, women, you know, I think of, like you said, like things that are dainty or delicate and beautiful. And, you know, to me, that symbolizes like what we traditionally consider the ideal. You know, we don't think about women as just being strong, resilient. But on the other, not so much that, but just being more masculine, I guess. But at the same time, like, yes, women, there are women that portray those qualities, but then you can have both, right? You can be also strong and resilient. And, you know, I think of like a dandelion, right? Maybe not considered traditionally beautiful in the sense, but, you know, they're hard to kill. They're, you know, they serve their purpose. They're great for pollinating and that sort of thing. And so, I think, too, that like some plants, like I said, are poisonous in that sense. And so it just runs the gamut. I think we traditionally consider the flower as just something beautiful and, like I said, delicate. And there are so many other sides to flowers and plants, just like there are so many other sides to women.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Tyler Streeter in San Francisco says, was the use of flora with the figure a light bulb, in inverted commas, moment, or did it develop over time? Yeah, here's another question, but I'll get to that in a sec.
Okay. I suppose it was kind of a light bulb moment, in the sense that I started these paintings of women, like women with flowers, right after I had my little girl. And it kind of, I can't say that I remember the aha moment, but I think at the time, you know, they're young and you don't have a whole lot of time to work. You don't have a whole lot of time to paint. And so you spend a lot of time in your mind. And, well, it's the truth, right? And So it was just there again, just like daydreaming and thinking about like what my body had gone through and what all women's bodies go through and what it's like to be a woman and how strong I felt and how to portray that. And also like thinking about, I was thinking about my daughter and like, it, you know, before I had my daughter, I would very much consider myself in obviously in favor of equality, but it was just kind of like it in, increased tenfold after my daughter. Cause you know, I wanted her to experience equality and not experience the things that, you know, I had experienced as a woman or, you know, that my friends and my sisters and my mother and all that had experienced. You know, you always want a better life for your kids. And so that was when I think that was when these paintings really came into fruition, or the idea of them anyway.
Yeah, right.
So, and the other part of that too was that, you know, when I had my little girl, I was asked all the time, like, so you're not going to paint anymore, right? Because you have a baby now. And I was like, no, that's my job. You know, and they wouldn't ask my husband that. It was like, it wasn't like, you know, they would ask, well, you're going to quit farming now that you have a daughter. You know, that wasn't even a consideration. And so, you know, that really spurred it on also.
Yeah, I can imagine. Tyler also asks, was there a painting that you feel was a turning point for you?
Yes, absolutely. The first painting that I did after I had my daughter was The Feeling of Falling. And it was the first painting. It was the one of the woman who was kind of, it was my sister, hovering above a chair with dahlias coming out of her back or sitting on top of her back. And so, yeah, I would say, you know, that was the seminal painting in this body of work, but also definitely I would consider it a turning point piece because it got the attention of some collectors and galleries that I would have never even dreamed of, you know, getting the attention of. And so it was kind of surreal in that sense. And it was weird too, because, you know, here it's like you're trying to balance taking care of a young child and, you know, writing pieces for magazine interviews and working on work and the, you know, the juggling act. It was pretty crazy there for a while.
Yeah, I can imagine. we'll get to that in a sec. There's a question about it, so I won't go into it now. Okay. Ashmika, I hope I got that right, in India says, wow, I'm in love with this artist. Fantastic conceptual figurative art. I wanted to know, sir, in most of Amanda Greaves' art, the face of the figure is concealed. Is there any specific reason or is it just spontaneous?
No, it's definitely deliberate. As far as like, I mean, you know, the flower faces, I think, whenever you ask that question, that comes to the forefront of my mind. So the women whose faces are concealed completely by flowers, it's deliberate in the sense that I want to make the feeling of the painting or the story behind the painting more generalized. So it's not just about maybe the specific woman, it's about women in general and their ability to relate to the story that or the idea behind the painting.
Yeah. Yeah, more generic. Yeah.
Right. Because a lot of times too, you know, I mean, whenever it's just the face, it becomes more portrait than it does the other. So yeah, that's why.
Yeah. Yeah, just from listening to the way you work there, I'm smiling about Ashmika asking you if it's just spontaneous because it sounds like, you know, I'll just won't do the faces. It doesn't sound like you work like that at all.
Nope.
Okay. I'll just ask you these. These are kind of, they're slightly odd questions. Jessica Nicole says, I've got two questions. Why was Soylent Green made out of people? And the second question is, why I like that guy named Pat in college? Looking forward to the answers. God, I hope you know this person, do you?
I do, yeah. She's one of my best
friends. Okay, that's a relief. She was just being cheeky. Good.
Yeah, no, she's a comedian. She's... So yeah, no, she didn't really mean them in seriousness.
All right, good. You never know. You have to, like, I just, you know, have to ask. All right, so Julie Hightower-Ryle asks or says, your paintings are really amazing. I see that you're a mama, and I'm wondering if you've young kids or did you paint with young kids? I'm a mom of young kids, aged 2, 4, 7, 8, and 9, and I'm getting back into painting. My kids actually inspire me to paint, but it's so challenging to find the time. When I have some time, it's hard to use it wisely. How do you manage being a mom and a painter? Thanks. And then Erin Millman says that she seconds this topic, this question.
Well, it's a balancing act for sure. Now, I will say that once, you know, I only have one child, so that, you know, is definitely not the same as having 3 or 4, obviously, as far as time constraints
go. Or in
her
case, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Oh, five.
Five all under the age of 9. My God.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a lot. but I had a lot of help. So my parents have always been uber supportive, and my husband too. So, you know, my parents would take my daughter for a while and, you know, once a week or whatever, and allow me to paint for a full day. That being said, you know, I think as with anything, it's what you make time for. So my free time, even if it was just like an hour or after my daughter would go to bed. So my painting day might start at 8 o'clock at night and go until midnight, you know, just to get in some time. But for me, it was important to keep that side of me. And so I was pretty diligent in making sure that I painted every day, even if it was just, you know, for half an hour, even if it was just mixing paints. You know, that was something that I was doing in my studio for myself. So, yeah, I did have a lot of help, but it was also making sure on a personal level that I made time for it. And it's still that way. I mean, I think as a woman and as a parent, sometimes it's hard to make a case for things that are important to you, you know, making a case, especially with art. I mean, with a traditional job, that's different, right? I mean, I think that that's more accepted if you're, you know, working in an office or you're, you know, have what one would consider a traditional job. It's a lot easier to make time for that. Whereas with art, you know, there are people that think that that is not necessarily a real job when really it is. And so, you know, you kind of always have to fight for that time, right? From the very beginning, I just have tried to make time for myself. And it, no, it's not like it used to be. It's not, you know, I can't paint for 10 hours a day like I used to. But that's okay. It'll eventually get back to that. And I feel like, too, that I'm setting a good example for my daughter, even though she doesn't know it now, you know, that... Yeah. That your passions and what you decide to do with your life are important, and that you should always, you know, think of yourself too, and not just think of what others would like you to do.
Yep. Yeah, very good. I can, concur, not from my own experience, but just from talking to different artists. And you mentioned Doriel Kamy, and she said something very similar. She doesn't have kids. But she was talking about if you've got to work a second job, the main thing is even if you do an hour, you know, a day, you're still a painter, you're still an artist, you know, don't just because you can't get big stretches of time. And then that other thing that you were saying about, you know, when you can't paint, you're still thinking about painting. I can relate to this quite well because I know from writing, like I have a friend who's writes scripts for TV and that kind of thing. And he was saying he does most of his work on the couch, you know, lying on the couch, just thinking about it. He's like, that's just as important. He said, I might spend 7 hours lying on the couch thinking about it and an hour writing, and both are as important. I probably got the ratio wrong. That sounds a bit much, doesn't it? But yeah, it's something like that anyway. Like a lot of time just thinking about it. So all that time, I know for myself, because I do all these different things, that I don't get to paint as much as I'd like to, but I'm thinking about painting a lot, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think as well that other thing of diminishing the fact that, you know, if you are an artist and you want to paint, it won't leave you alone. Like, it'll keep pestering you. So even Isn't if you physically truth? Cannot get it organized in the day, like, the fact that it's bothering you and that you want to paint, like, I think that's really important to acknowledge that and go, yeah, I'm still a painter. I just can't get there at the minute. Because a lot of people write to me and sort of, you know, they're sort of saying, oh, the podcast is great and everything. Of course they're saying that. But then also they're saying, yeah, I haven't painted in 30 years. I'm just getting back to it. Like men and women, you know, it's like either they've had, you know, careers or they've been parents or just something, you know, but it doesn't leave you alone. Like, it just eventually calls you back to the easel.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. And the other side of that is that you can't escape it, right? I mean, it's hard to not think about it. And so you think of like people who get to physically leave the office. Well, we really can't leave the office, right? Because the office mainly resides in our head.
Yep.
So, but no, I absolutely agree with you. And honestly, that's kind of one of my favorite parts about being an artist is that it's very mobile. Like, I can, you know, think about, you can, like I said, go down that rabbit hole of thinking about different topics and how they could become paintings. And it's always awesome, like, when you have kind of that aha moment for that next painting, you know, it's instantly energizing. And it's like you're scrambling for a notebook so that you don't forget this fleeting idea. And I, you know, I even keep a notebook by my bed because it's like, you know, right before I go to sleep, whenever you're letting your mind wander and just kind of settle down a little bit, it's amazing how you can kind of access these different ideas a little more readily than you would like during the day, whenever you're being, you know, your attention is being grabbed by all sorts of different things.
So. Yeah, definitely. And we've got so many cool things to help us, like phones, you know, like if you're out and about and you see something that just strikes you visually, you can whip out your phone and, you know, you've got it. And they've got, you can do little voice memos. And as you say, pads, like I've got pads all over the place.
Oh, right. Because,
yeah. Yeah. I always get the best ideas, like either when I'm doing yoga or I'm meditating or, you know, something, you know, or in the shower.
Yeah. Well, that's
always inconvenient.
Ask. Yeah. Do you think that meditation has really helped you kind of come up with ideas or has opened your mind to different sorts of topics and that sort of thing? I mean, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, I've been doing it a long time. Like, I've been meditating, like, I don't know, 35 years or something like that. So it's just kind of part of what I do. But yeah, like, the way I meditate is I'm very focused on not thinking. So I'll have a pad beside me because, you know, like, I'll, you know, generally I sort of meditate for about 15 minutes at a time. And you know, I'll set a timer for that because I don't want to be thinking about how long I've been meditating for, which I would. I'd be, you know, my eyes closed and gone, is that 15 minutes?
Oh, I know. Hey,
must be, you know.
I am the same way. I am not, I'm a spotty meditator, but when I do, it's like I set my phone and I'm looking forward to joining your Further Emergence meditation sessions because I get notifications for them, but you know, usually I have to go back to them after the fact to do it.
Yeah, watch them afterwards. Yeah, a lot of people do that. Yeah, they watch them afterwards. The live side of it is nice, but yeah, it's just, yeah, you can meditate along to the video. But yeah, I do the same with the pad. Like, if particularly if I've got something going on, like that I've been thinking about, I go, oh, I better put some paper beside me, because in the same way, you know, I'll start off and I'll be not thinking and everything's going great. But then it'll be like, hey, what about this brilliant idea? And it's like, okay, yeah, in 15 minutes, I will write that down. I was like, no, but then there's this side of it and that side of it. And then if I did it this way, it's like, fine. And so I'll open my eyes, just write it down. So I can stop thinking about it. And then I can get back to meditating.
Right, so. Yeah. Whenever I worked in legal research, you know, in the office, and what I did is I edited court documents and researched their citations and that sort of thing. And so, you know, there'd be times it's like, I'd have post-it notes by me. It's like, you know, oh gosh, you know, write that down and stick it to the to the desk so I didn't forget it. So by the end of the day, you'd have like four or five post-it notes of ideas that you had in the process of the day, but you didn't want to forget them. And so, yeah, then you just, I'd take my post-its and take them home and stick them in my notebook.
Yeah. Yeah. I've drawn more bad pictures on the glass in the shower. because, yeah, I can't bring a notepad into the shower. I think you can actually get little whiteboards for the shower, but yeah, that's, yeah. I haven't.
Well, and they have waterproof paper, you know. My husband used to use it. He had like a little notepad that was waterproof that he'd use when he was, you know, out farming and whatever. So they do have those too.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. okay. If there was one main underlying theme to all your work, what do you think it would be?
I would say probably the quest for equality and addressing gender stereotypes, I suppose. I mean, I guess that's pretty basic, but I would say at its core, at its foundation, that's what they're about.
Right. Just looking at the work that you have on your website, so you have it separated into, I think it's before 2014 and then after 2014. Is that, have I got that right? Roughly there.
Yeah, it's 2014 or 2015. I can't remember.
And there seems to be a significant difference. I mean, there's a transition, all right, but your work before, like in the pre-2014, was very Trump-alloy, very still life, and a different kind of quality to it. Mm-hmm. Is that around the birth of your daughter, or is that just me? Is that just the way I'm registering it, or do you see that there's a significant difference between, you know, 14 and then after 14?
Oh yeah, no, without a doubt. I think you're right, and yeah, that was right before my daughter was born, and I would say, like, you know, the ones that are in the category of being before 2014, 2015, they were more academic, more still life related. And also too, you know, when I was going to school, I would do some figural work, but did have a professor that's like, you should not be doing figures. You're no good at them. And so, you know, the impressionable mind that I was just kind of like, okay, whatever you say, God. I won't. And so, you know, I kind of got to a point where it's like, oh yeah, you don't think I can do them? Well, you know, watch this. And so, yeah, I would say that was kind of the turning point.
Yeah. What was your attraction to Trump-alloy?
I loved how people would view the painting and get up really close. And like, I'd put like a fly on the painting and they'd try to brush it away, or, you know, duct tape, trying to see if the duct tape was real. I loved that sort of like first, like visceral response to a piece. I think that's why I was so drawn to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it looks to me like it, you know, because Trump-alloy is not an easy thing to figure out how to do, to learn how to do. But it looks to me like it's informed, even though your more recent work doesn't have that kind of Trump-alloy thing going on. But there's something about your current work that it's been informed by it. Do you see that as well, or is that just me?
No, I would think so. Yes. I mean, I guess in the sense that there's sort of a three-dimensional quality to it. You know, you always kind of like to have that, I think of it as like a push and pull, right? You know, and like a sparkle, like there's elements that kind of make the objects in the paintings pop out and kind of have that sort of push and pull. And so, yeah, I can, in that sense, yes.
Yeah, just as you're talking there, I'm remembering Robert Lang. He was talking about, because he does some sort of Trump-alloy thing, and he was saying that for him, the real trick to Trump-alloy is the shadows. Yes. And just remembering what you were saying about your blacks, and getting a little bit clearer about what I meant to myself, I think it's the sense of depth actually in your paintings. Yeah, you know, if I had to sort of say, where's the Trump-alloy influence? It's that they seem to recede to much more into infinity than other paintings.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I thank my art professor for that, for giving me that tip on those darks, I guess. But yeah, no, I like that.
Is he the same one who said you couldn't paint figures?
Oh, no, not at all. Okay. Not at all. No, all right, he has always been probably one of my staunchest supporters. And in fact, it was his kind of pushing me and, you know, telling me that I could do this is what made me really believe that I could.
Great. So. Great. So you mentioned a little bit about that pivotal painting. The name is just escaping me again.
The Feeling of
that
Falling.
That's it, yeah. That one, where galleries got in touch with you and it, you know, changed things for you. Because the art business is something that comes up regularly on the podcast. And just how has your experience of it been?
I would say pretty good so far. I mean, I wouldn't say that I have any horror stories or anything. yeah, you know, and I'm sure this is the way it is for a lot of artists. I am a better artist than I am a businesswoman. So, you know, that part has always been pretty hard for me, just like the marketing part of it and putting yourself out there. And, you know, we do have fragile egos and we're painting our feelings and stuff. And so that part of it has been hard for me. But, you know, the galleries that I've worked with have been absolutely gracious and kind and have helped me. And though I'm not like, you know, I don't have official representation with the gallery, the galleries that I do work with have really taught me a lot about just the business side of it. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't, that's pretty vague, I guess, but I wouldn't say that I don't know that I would have any sort of consequential information that would, you know, be of any use to anybody other than just jump right in there. And, you know, the other part of that too, is that like we have social media now and Facebook and Instagram is just basically like a walking gallery. Right. So,
yeah,
it's nice to have that too.
Yeah. Your online presence though is very together. It's very good. Like your website's very nice. Your Instagram is good. Then you've got your Facebook. There's a nice continuity. Like sometimes people, it can be a little bit patchy or a little bit, you know, looked at from a potential collector's point of view. You know, I look at some people's online presence and go, well, they're not making it easy for themselves at all. They're making it hard. You know, the collector's got to wade through all these pictures of the family barbecue and, you know, right. Okay, I'm exaggerating, but you know what I mean? It's like that just doesn't have a nice kind of ease to it, but yours is very good. I was quite struck by that.
Thank you. Well, it's deliberate, you know. For me, I cringe at the idea of having to take a selfie or having any sort of like part of my private life on display, but I like social media for that, the aspect that I can have such control over the art that people see that is mine. So I love it for that, but I try to shy away from posting a bunch of personal stuff.
Yeah. So what sort of price range are your paintings selling for at the moment?
It depends on the size, obviously. Anywhere from a couple $1,000s to $10,000 right now.
So. Okay. And that's gallery price.
Well, no. Yes and no. I do sell some through galleries, but I also sell some through Instagram too. So it's just kind of a mix.
Okay. All right. Did that just happen spontaneously on Instagram? People just got in touch, or do you cultivate it?
I wouldn't say that I guess in a perfect world, I could say, yes, I cultivate it and I seek out.
I made it happen. Yes.
It was all me. I don't know. Yes, I have people that have spontaneously contacted me or have seen my art, and I don't know how the algorithms work and all that, but luckily for me, most of the time it pans out. I mean, I know that, you know, you get like people interested in your work or act like they're interested all the way up to the last minute and then kind of ghost you or whatever. But, look at the guy that, what is that, that spam, like the guy that's looking for a piece for his wife and, you know, is interested in
something. I get one of them a week.
Right. Me too.
I had a different one today, actually. It was the other way around. It was like, I want to buy a surprise painting for my husband. I noticed him looking at your work in his brow, on his browser.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Which is hilarious. Yeah. Because yeah. I don't want to be cliched, but I imagine, you know, that if a wife was checking her husband's browser, she might be horrified rather than finding him looking at fine art.
She's not looking to other see things. What paintings he likes.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I've been lucky so far to, have very gracious collectors contact me about works and buy pieces through Instagram, more so Instagram than Facebook, but also through galleries. Yeah.
The other reason I'm asking you about that is because you said you liked Ashley Longshore and she's kind of built her art. Well, I think it's an empire now on Instagram. So yeah, I'm just wondering if it was a conscious thing that you, you know, have include, you know, DM me for this is available, or, you know, the sorts of things that people include when they're showcasing their art on Instagram that they do want to sell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I look at her work and how she navigates Instagram, but also other artists that I really like who I know sell through Instagram or, you know, other social media sites as kind of like templates for how I conduct my myself on online and trying to sell work. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah. She is definitely somebody that I look up to in that respect.
Yeah, we all do. When we all grow up, we want to be like Ashley Longshore.
Oh, without a doubt.
Just
right?
Professionally. Yeah. maybe not, but I'm me anyway. in one way or another. Do you know then where most of your collectors are located?
Some of them, not all of them. Obviously, I mean, if they contact me directly, then I do. But works that I've sold through galleries, I'm not normally privy to that information. The gallery doesn't usually tell me where it's going, just that it's going.
And do you keep in touch with your collectors? Do you have a little private newsletter or anything like that? Or do you just, you know, record where they came from and leave it at that? Like, do you cultivate the relationship?
You know, I guess in a perfect world, I would have like a newsletter or something like that. If I were uber organized, which I'm not, I always think, oh, I should get a newsletter going. But then I'm like, oh no, that's going to take a little more work than I'm willing to put out right now. I try to cultivate a relationship. I guess, you know, though I'm very introverted and I'm uber cognizant of other people's feelings and I never want to be really pushy. And I guess that's kind of like the anti-marketing part of me. It's like I want to cultivate these relationships, but I don't want to seem too pushy either. And so I'd rather it be a little more organic, like they just see the work and don't feel like, you know, I'm saying, you know, shaking a painting in their face and saying, buy this sort of thing. So.
And are most of your collectors in America or are they all over the world or?
For all I know, most of them are in America. But like I said, you know, I don't really know.
Of the ones I know.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So when you think about all the paintings that you've made, is there one that stands out for you that was particularly moving for you to make?
That's kind of a hard question. I mean, the easy answer would be The Feeling of Falling because it was so transformative for me as an artist. So whenever I think of my initial response when I think of a painting that has had a huge effect on me, it's that one. But also there are, like, I've done a few self-portraits and those I feel like are pretty important to me, just in the sense that, you know, as somebody who's visual, whose language is visual, I guess, it's easier to put what I'm feeling out on canvas than to actually talk about it. And so, so I would say too, like, you know, I've done a couple self-portraits, and that's probably, those have been pretty important to me also in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Christina Gray says, I have a few questions for you. I think Christina is your sister, isn't she?
Yes, she's my sister.
Or just
sister.
A friend. And she's your sister. Yeah.
No, she's my sister. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. She says, what would your dream, what would be your dream project to do?
You know, barring monetary needs and like basic science principles, I would love to be able to recreate all of the tents in the book, The Night Circus. You know, they've got, have you read that book?
No, I haven't.
So it's a great book by Aaron Morgenstern, but the tents in it are like, it's about a circus. And so the tents in the circus are like, the pool of tears, or like, a tent that you go in and you smell, jars, and they recreate these memories, but then you find out that the jars are actually memories. And so I think it would be amazing to kind of create this all-encompassing world where I could include my paintings, but also kind of make this sort of like magical realm, kind of in the same, same realm as like, the interactive theater, Sleep No More, that's in New York, and it's about Macbeth. And, you know, it's interactive in the sense that you, you're in a warehouse, but it's meant to look as different environments, and you, you know, you don't, you become completely consumed by it. You know, you're just in this, you're just kind of like dropped into this world. And so, yeah, I would love to do something like that.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like, you know, give it another couple of years, and I think virtual reality will be at a stage where, you know, we can just do those sort of things ourselves. I mean, it's getting closer all the time.
That's true. That's true. That's a good point. So yeah, if I, in a perfect world, I would love to do something like that.
All right. And then her other question is, what superpower would you want and why?
Invisibility, obviously, so that I could sneak up on people talking about my work and hear what they actually think.
What they really think, yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So of all the superpowers, that's what you want. Okay, good. Sort of on a similar vein, but do you have a big art dream you'd like to achieve before you die?
Not really. I mean, I think like any other artist, I would like to be successful. Not so much in, I guess, in the monetary sense, sure. You would like to be able to support yourself doing what you love. But I want to just, I feel like I just want to make a difference. I want to be somebody who is just like a catalyst for change, and a catalyst really for thought, right? So I would be happy with that.
Right. Okay. Yeah. How would you know?
Exactly. No. Well, that's where the invisibility part comes in, right?
Okay. Right. That's making sense. No, but invisibility to one side, that's a hard thing to know, you know, how, or maybe it isn't, maybe, you know, I would find it like as a, something to kind of aspire towards. How would you know you were affecting change? I suppose people would tell you, would they?
Yes. So, you know, and I've had, I guess with my work, like, you know, it has like what I would call, or I used to call, this notion of everyday feminist. So it's subtle, you know, it's not completely overt, and it lends itself to conversations. And sometimes those conversations are a little uncomfortable, but I would like to think that they make the viewer think about alternate points of view. And so yeah, in that sense, I mean, I would hope it affects change like that, in that way.
Yeah. Have you found that women respond differently to your work than men?
Yes. I think probably because, you know, they're paintings of women and they resonate with women and their experiences, maybe more so than men. But, you know, at the same time, I've had men who have been, who say they have been really moved by the work, and it's really interesting to have those conversations and to get their opinion, or, you know, what the painting means to them, or what sort of feelings were conjured by viewing it. So yeah, I would say, yeah. You know.
Yeah. The reason I ask is, for me, like looking at them, they're very powerful and very strong and all the other things that I said about them, but I get a very strong sense that I'm looking at a window into what it is to be a woman. And in a way, they sort of seem like that they're, you know, like the way they used to talk about women's business, like this is women's business. Mm-hmm. And like that women would, you know, it's like if I was standing beside a woman looking at one of your paintings, I kind of had this feeling like the woman is seeing a lot of things that I'm just missing here because I'm just not seeing them, you know? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but yeah. So, but there again, like it is a conversation starter, right? I mean, because of just what you're saying, like, so then, you know, hopefully that leads to like, you as a woman, or what do you think of this and how does that affect you? And hopefully that colors like, you know, the male perspective of what, it's like to be female and living now.
Yeah. Okay. What's the biggest challenge you're facing at the moment, as an artist?
Time constraints, really. I mean, it's starting to get back to normal a little bit now, but just like, you know, the pandemic threw a wrench in things, and even just like having, gallery shows and openings canceled and that sort of thing, you know, you tend to rely more heavily on your online presence now, than having, you know, receptions where you could interact with the guests and with collectors and talk face to face. You don't really have that anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Last question. So, okay. I ask this question to everyone who comes on the podcast. And that's if there's one thing you could pass on to future generations, what would it be? And it doesn't have to be about art.
Let's see. One thing I'd pass on would be just to stick to your dreams, right? I mean, I always think about like how many people told Spielberg that he shouldn't make movies, right? Even if it's really crazy, if you think it can happen and you have the motivation and the desire to make something happen, then you'll do it, right? So I think we get things get kind of convoluted, like we get pressure to act a certain way and to follow a certain path when really that's not what is our heart's desire. And so if I could tell anybody in the future, it would just be to like just stay the course. And it's not always easy, but that just means that it's more worthwhile. If something isn't easily attained, doesn't mean that it's not worth it.
Yeah, very good. Don't give up.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it's always very refreshing when you come across those kind of memes or, you know, on the internet, either of, you know, a list of people who are well-known successes now and where they were, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago, whether it was working in a, you know, burger place or getting, you know, getting repeated refusals, or, I mean, there's so many people that's happened for us. It's so true what you're saying.
Yep. I agree.
Okay. What is the best place for people to find your work online?
Probably the best place is Instagram. So my username is Amanda_Grieve, and my last name is Grieve. So it's kind of counter to what you would normally think it would be. So, but yeah, probably Instagram is what I update the most frequently, and Facebook too. but more so Instagram.
Okay. And then your website is, what's your website?
It's amandagrieve.com. Right. Yep.
.com. Yeah. Yeah. I'll put links in the show notes to all that, but yeah, just if you're listening and you don't want to have to go to the show notes, you can find them. Okay. Well, great. It's been lovely chatting with you. As I say, I think your work is really fantastic, really good. And yeah, for all the things that we've been talking about, very powerful, very unique. I think it's very unique, like coming across your work and just being really struck by it, by the power of it, the depth of it. The technical skill, of course, is beautiful, but there's a lot going on there. And I was very looking forward to actually talking to you and getting a sense of you as a person, because they're so multi-layered, your paintings, and it's not like they don't give a lot away. They do give a lot away, but I became quite curious about what the person is like who made these paintings, you know? So that's been good. So yeah, great. And they're brilliant. They're really great.
Thank you. And I really appreciate you having me on. I mean, I kind of feel like it's a rite of passage. Like I was so excited when you contacted me to be on your podcast. So I've done interviews before, but never a podcast. So I was pretty excited.
Right, passage, great. Yeah, I saw somebody made a comment, the big time. You may hit the big time, so that's great.
It felt like, I idolize a lot of your guests, and it's just like, oh, I get to, be on a podcast where he's talked to these people too. And so, yeah, it was pretty amazing. So thank you.
Yeah. No, you're very welcome. And you're right up there with them.
I'm not
just saying that. Yeah. Well, thanks. I wouldn't have asked you if I didn't think that. Yeah, I wouldn't have asked you to come on.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Okay, so yeah, I keep in touch with everybody, so we will probably keep in touch.
That sounds great.
But for now, we'll say goodbye.
Okay, goodbye.
I've never felt this good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti.
Actually, I'd prefer a cup of tea. Cup of tea would be lovely. So yeah, just a little reminder, mainly because every second or third person who becomes a patron has got in touch with me and said, you know what, I've been listening to your podcast for ages and I didn't become a patron, not because I don't have the money, not because I don't think it's great, I just didn't get around to it. So this is a little friendly reminder that if you'd like to be a patron, you'd like to buy me a cup of tea, go to patreon.com/JohnDalton, gently does it, all one word. Or follow the link in the show notes to become a patron. I would really appreciate it if you could do that, particularly if you've been meaning to and you just haven't got around to it. It would be great. It would mean a lot to me. All right. Thank you. Bye.
We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. Come on, buy us a drink. Come on, buy us a drink. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. Come on.